Dr. Ian Proven is the Marshall Shepherd Professor of Biblical Studies at Regent College in Vancouver in Canada, where he has taught since 1997. He's an accomplished biblical scholar and the author of commentaries on the Old Testament books of Lamentations, 1 and 2 Kings, Ecclesiastes and the Song of Songs. And he's also the co-author of A Biblical History of Israel. I'm told he also has a passion for soccer. Is that right, Ian?
That's absolutely right.
A recent article in Australia's ABC Religion and Ethics site claimed that virtually no biblical historian believes the accounts of the key events of the Old Testament to be reliable. So he was thinking of events like the Israelites being in Egypt, the Exodus, the conquest of the land of Canaan, and so on. Ian, how do you respond to that sort of one-liner?
I'd just say I'm kind of surprised, would be putting it mildly. I just don't think it's factually the case. You know, you'd have to be drawing your circle of biblical historians pretty tightly to be able to make that kind of sweeping statement. I think it's way more complicated than that.
What's the ground look like in terms of the scholarship in this area?
Well, it's very mixed, and part of the problem here is it's not just a matter of arguments about evidence. It's also arguments about the very nature of history and how we know what we know and so on. So people are not just disagreeing about the facts on the ground, as it were. There are also kind of implicit disagreements about these bigger questions. And these are the questions that are actually not often discussed. You know, how do we know anything? You know, what would evidence look like? What would you expect to find from these ancient cultures that would help us in this area? You know, I mean, if we're thinking of something like Abraham, we're talking about a relatively small extended family passing across the pages of ancient Near Eastern history. And you have to ask, you know, which kind of evidence would you expect to find of that kind of thing? When you have a state of Israel that's visibly there as an actual state, then you do begin to find lots of references and sideways allusions and so on. And that's exactly what you would expect. So I think that the nature and extent of the evidence is more or less what you would expect to find given the story we're dealing with.
It is a long time ago, though, isn't it? Even with the New Testament, there's a lot more material that we have to work with. How do you get people to think, yeah, I can see this material as something I can rely upon to say something to me today?
Yeah, well, that's a tricky one, because we're living in a kind of general culture now where I don't think the level of knowledge even about the information is very high, much less the kind of level of knowledge about what it might signify. So the question of how you engage people with that is actually a very tricky one. You know, and I mean, my professional life is more or less devoted to that. And I can't say it's easy, because you have to be on the radar screen before you can actually expect people to be, you know, dealing with it.
What got you interested in the Old Testament particularly?
Well, when I was at college, I really wasn't that interested in it, to be honest with you. I mean, the New Testament seemed much more compelling. But I gradually, over the years, became aware of the fact that we do have two parts to this Bible, and that they ought to really have some relationship to each other. And I began to realize that really to understand the New Testament, you had to really grapple with the Old Testament. So I got into that, and that's been a large part of my interest in the books I've written and the teaching that I do as well.
What's been the most rewarding aspect of delving deeply into Old Testament books?
I think the discovery that the literature we're dealing with is way more sophisticated than people might think in terms of its literary artistry and so on. That's one thing. I mean, it's just really good literature, quite apart from anything else. And secondly, the level of enrichment you get in reading the New Testament when you really have grappled with the Old Testament. So those two things together, probably.
We often hear people say Christian believers try to read the Old Testament through the lens of the New Testament. Is that a fair way of describing it?
I think it's a fair way of describing the facts on the ground. I think that's often the way people do it. For myself, I think it's better to read it in a more two-way thing, you know, two-way manner, allowing the Old Testament to stand on its own integrity and to address the new as well as back and forth. So I see it more as a conversation. And I think there's a danger of narrowing the Old Testament down, really, and into a very kind of reductive kind of reality if you just go one way.
You're taking on its own terms.
And what you're really doing there is you're putting yourself as much as you can back into the mind and the body of a first century person. so that when you're hearing the words of Jesus in the New Testament, you're also hearing all the echoes, all the allusions, all the backstory. So that kind of empathy is a big part, I think, of understanding any part of history, actually.
I'm speaking with Dr. Ian Proven, who is a professor of biblical studies at Regent College in Vancouver, Canada. He's a specialist in the Old Testament. Ian, the critics of Christianity in recent times have had fun quoting from some of the more violent parts of the Old Testament, saying this material reflects ancient tribal practices. They're really barbaric. And they've got a lot to work with, haven't they? There's a heck of a lot of very violent material. But are they wrong to suggest that really because of that, you know, we've moved beyond that, we should just let it go?
Well, I mean, if they think we've moved beyond violence, they're not living in the world I'm living in. You know, I think violence has been a pretty intrinsic part of human existence right from the beginning. And anthropologists tell us that, you know, it was no different way back in the day than it is now. So I don't think we'll ever escape from violence. I think the problem maybe that people have more with the Old Testament is that it appears that maybe God is sanctioning violence and things like ethnic cleansing and so on. So I think we do have to handle these questions carefully. I don't think they've always been handled well in the past. Where I would begin, though, with that is I would point out that the very reason we have these texts is because they were handed on to us by people who spent a lot of time telling you they thought God was good and loving and just and all those things. So whatever we do with this violent stuff, we have to recognize that for these people, it was only part of a much larger picture.
When people make this criticism, the violence of the Old Testament, as you said, especially when it looks as though God is not just sanctioning, he's actually calling for this sort of stuff, the Amalekites and so on, where we see men, women, children and animals are told to be put to the sword, it jars, doesn't it, for someone who's used to hearing about the character of God reflected particularly in the person of Jesus, as someone who turns away from violence.
And we have a history behind us now, of course, of people using these texts to justify their own violence, which is not a happy set of associations. I do think it's important, though, to try to understand the Old Testament on its own terms, first of all, before we start launching into a critique. If you actually read these texts, you'll discover that the notion of violence is never actually divorced from the notion of justice. So again, whatever you're going to do with it, you have to, I think, try and be fair to the literature in its own terms, first of all. It's certainly not arbitrary, random violence we're talking about here. It's very much a matter of the justice of God, which for these authors is an aspect simply of the goodness of God.
And it's for a specific time, a specific place, an event that isn't repeatable.
No, absolutely. I mean, if you look at something like the Exodus, that's an event the whole biblical tradition constantly looks back to, that kind of redemption out of oppression. If you look at something like the warfare in Canaan, for example, that's absolutely not regarded as repeatable. In fact, it's regarded as extremely unusual, and it's not somehow laying down principles of behavior for people in future times. And I think the biblical tradition is actually very clear on that point. But you know, we're dealing with a biblical story that begins by telling you that God is good and that God's purpose in the world is to bless and to rescue and all these other things. So contextualizing is the big thing here. Dragging things out of context is really not going to help anyone.
And when you do contextualize them, you obviously think there are some satisfying answers to dealing with the material.
I do. I mean, I don't think the Bible's task is actually to help us to come up with the kind of answers we'd like on every topic. But it does seem to me that the judgment of God is simply an aspect of goodness. And I think we can see that even in our own world. I don't think we should regard it as good if we have a relaxed attitude towards oppression and violence, for example. And so the notion of there being somebody who brings accountability, who brings justice and so on, is a really important biblical idea.
Sometimes strikes me that what's unique about this material is that this is a people telling its own history and showing themselves to be an absolute disaster.
Yeah, well, that's a very important point, because if you compare biblical literature with the literature of contemporary peoples round about, it is unique. And one of the ways in which it's unique is its human scale, its real humanity. You know, we're not dealing with heroes and gods here. We're dealing with ordinary people who are presented as being just like you and me. And they're not presenting themselves, as you say, in a very good light. It's interesting that almost every biblical character actually has a shadow side. Mm. And it's always struck me as one of the real indicators of authenticity, actually, that that's the case.
The Old Testament is written in a very patriarchal society, isn't it? In these stories we read that women are barely more than property. In what sense, then, could reading the Old Testament be good news for a modern woman?
Well, that's a really good and important question in our present contemporary moment, and I think it does require, again, very careful handling. Again, I want to begin at the beginning, though. I mean, we have to reckon seriously with the fact that the book of Genesis begins by telling us that human beings, male and female, are made in the image of God. Any story that begins by telling you that is surely making a very significant statement, not only about the value of every single human person, but the fact it's every single human person, both male and female. So again, I think part of the problem here is not contextualizing some of the other material correctly within the story.
As the biblical story unfolds, presumably the reporting of things doesn't necessarily signify approval of. Would that be fair to say?
That's right. And what we said a moment ago about the shadow side of people comes into play here. I think it's one of the mistakes people sometimes make to think that because we have a holy book here, everyone in it has to be, you know, a paradigm for our imitation. The Bible itself does not believe that for one moment. And so when you're reading stories of what people are doing to each other or the way they're treating each other or regarding each other, you have to be really careful moving from that description of a story to some kind of principled ethical stance on the whole kind of issue.
As if that one would follow from the other. I mean, one story that's commonly brought out, and you can see why, is the story of Jephthah, right?
Jephthah is one of the judges. He's one of the early leaders of Israel, and he makes a very foolish vow to God that if he wins this battle, that he'll sacrifice whichever one of his possessions meets him when he comes back from battle. And of course, in that cultural context, his daughter is regarded as one of his possessions. She runs out, and so she, you know, ends up being the sacrifice. But yeah, again, this question of context is interesting. The book of Judges really presents a society that's spiraling downwards. And as you go through the Judges, you're getting to more and more questionable characters in this story. And Samson comes after Jephthah. And, you know, Samson is a very strange guy, right? So very strange guy, yeah. So Jephthah is already, you're reading Jephthah in that frame of reference. It's obviously not presented to us as a smart thing that he does. Jewish tradition later blames Jephthah mightily, you know, for this. And I think the reader is left asking things like, well, okay, you made a vow to God. It was a dumb vow. Why didn't you just break it and take the consequences, you know? So again, you can't move in a straight line from description to prescription. That's one neat little way of saying it, from what's described to what people ought to do. And Jephthah is not held up as a paradigm for imitation in this bit of idiocy that he engages in.
So far from, as you say, a story that reflects something that God would be, you know, approving of, it shows he's deeply flawed character in every sense, both in the vow that he makes and then the way that he follows it through.
Absolutely. I mean, God doesn't actually show up at that bit in the story, and we don't hear what God thinks about this or anything like it. And I think you, as a reader of a story, you have to notice the absences as well as what's being said.
You just come back to the beginning. You said, you know, in Genesis we get this very important description at the beginning that all people, men and women, it's a radical idea at the time, made in the image of God. Now, you've also written that the vision of Genesis of the relationship between men and women is one of radical mutuality. That hasn't been the experience of women throughout the church's history, though, has it?
No, it hasn't. I don't see it as part of my job, really, to defend the history of the church in all respects. That's also a story of flawed people not always getting it right. I mean, I think, you know, personally, I think Christians have done an awful lot of good in the world and have changed the world much for the better. I don't think we fully understand any longer or remember culturally the ways in which that's the case. But no, I don't have a brief to defend every way in which Christians have behaved, and I certainly don't think the way in which women have been treated in the church has always reflected these Genesis ideas.
Now, Ian, you think that the Old Testament has relevance for things like creation care today or even working with the environment. How's that?
Well, again, and this is a bit of a theme, I guess, with me, I want to begin this thinking in Genesis 1 and 2. If you ask yourself the question, what does it mean to be made in the image of God as far as the book of Genesis is concerned, it's pretty clear that that's about looking after the rest of creation. So there are two metaphors used there. One is of the ruler, the person who actually, you know, rules over, the king type figure. And then the other image is that of the priest, the one who kind of mediates blessing. And the metaphor really in Genesis 2 is of looking after the garden. So I think it's very clear that we're not talking about exploitative, rapacious kind of, you know, dominion. We're actually talking about looking after a world that's not yours to begin with. It belongs to God. It's God's garden. That is of enormous importance, I think, to the current debates and discussions about the environment and so on.
Yeah, and the idea that the trajectory that the Bible suggests that we are on is towards a renewed creation, that ought to have something to say to us, shouldn't it, in terms of the way we deal with the environment around us?
I absolutely think so. And I think one of the real problems here that we have to address is that whereas for the biblical authors, if I can put it this way, God is a materialist. God loves matter, and the world is not a mistake. It's not a prison for our souls and so on.
That stands in distinction to other ancient Near Eastern stories of how this works.
It stands in distinction to all of them. It stands very starkly in distinction to the typical Greek worldview. But unfortunately, of course, Christians in dialoguing with the Greeks tended to allow too many ideas to cross over the bridge the opposite direction. So this has led to not just a perception that Christians are kind of otherworldly, but we have to be honest, an actual reality that all too often Christians are inappropriately otherworldly. Certainly the Bible, though, in talking about the future, talks about a new heavens and a new earth. It doesn't talk about us going somewhere else, and it doesn't encourage a kind of lazy attitude, therefore, towards the creation.
What about economic modeling and principles around, say, care for the less fortunate? Does the Old Testament have something to say to those things that still applies? I've heard some Christians say, oh, look, that's the Old Testament. Can't apply those sort of things like Jubilee, for instance, the principle of that.
Well, you certainly can't just lift it all across wholesale as if the ancient world was the same as our world. I mean, that should be obvious. On the other hand, you might expect, since God hasn't changed, that some of the principles of Old Testament ethical thinking about economics, among other things, should still apply if they reflect the character of God. So the idea of looking after the poor and the marginalized, the widow and the orphan in the language of the Old Testament, and a number of the more practical suggestions about how you ensure that things do not get out of proportion with regard to rich and poor, I think these principles are picked up in the New Testament, in fact, and have always been part of genuinely Orthodox Christian belief.
The Bible's had a huge influence on Western culture, but the knowledge of that is very poor these days, might be fair to say, even among church-going people. What do we stand to lose as a culture if the knowledge of the Bible disappears?
Well, I think this is a very significant point in relation to where post-Christian Western culture stands. In my estimation, we are living off the capital of that Judeo-Christian worldview, while essentially forgetting more and more where the capital comes from. And we seem to be under the illusion, as I would think, that we can continue to protect these things that we value without the story out of which they emerge. I think that's profoundly misguided, in fact.
What are the things that we most might lose that, say, someone listening might think, yeah, no, we don't want to lose that?
Well, let's go back to the idea that every individual person is precious to God. I mean, the whole notion of human rights, for example, emerges out of this story. I don't think people really understand that. They seem to think that human rights are a kind of self-evident feature of nature or some such thing. I think that's patently false. And it seems to me that the insistence on the preciousness of each individual person would certainly be liable to erosion if enough people forget this story and cease to live in that within that framework.
Now, studying the Old Testament has given you an academic career, but what has it given you in terms of yourself as a person?
Well, I think the Apostle Paul, when he's writing to Timothy much later on, talks about the Scriptures as being useful for a number of purposes. In 2 Timothy 3:16, a very well-known verse in Christian circles, I think, and rightly so. I think it's often forgotten that Paul is mainly talking there about the Old Testament, because the New Testament doesn't at that point exist as a body of documents. And I have certainly found in my personal life and my family life and my life as a citizen and so on that these Scriptures do give me a framework and a set of guidelines for living life that actually work. I mean, pragmatism is not the only test of truth and value, but it's certainly a pretty good test. It's one of them. And, you know, I've lived enough of life now to be able to say that I've found these Scriptures actually to be a lamp for the journey, which is a biblical metaphor, in fact, about this kind of thing. So,
another big biblical concept is one of forgiveness. Is that a strong theme? We know it's a big theme in the New Testament. Is it coming out of something that's already there?
Well, I think all of these big theological themes of the New Testament are already theological themes of the Old. And although it is, we talked earlier about the violence, for example, I sometimes think these texts about violence are a bit like a bad car accident. They kind of draw your eye in a way that then is disproportionate. In fact, the biblical view of God is that God is slow to anger, that God is always looking for people to turn around, that God himself is much more interested in forgiving than anything else. We're told that God delights in showing mercy. We're never told that God delights in bringing judgment. So the forgiveness of God, and then of course the fundamental of the Christian worldview is that we are to be like God. And Jesus himself says that, and so forgiveness becomes a huge part then of the Christian worldview as well.
If you were to sum up the key idea of the Old Testament, what would it be?
I think the key idea is that God is good. Some people might think it's that God is one and not many, but actually you could have one God that was malevolent. And in fact, many people think that's the God we have there. But to those people, for all of their own suffering and for all of their own puzzlement and all the things that they themselves did not understand, they were fundamentally convinced that God was a good person, so personal and good, and everything else flows out of that, it seems to me.
Has your experience of life been that you can trust that God is good?
In the long term, yes, but like everyone else on the planet, there are obviously phases of my life where I have doubted that and have not seen it. So we can't remove the idea of trust and faith. You know, that's a very profound part of the biblical tradition as well, that God ultimately will be seen to be good, but you won't necessarily see how that's working out. We can think of a story like the story of Joseph, for example. I mean, Joseph is betrayed by his brothers. He's sold into slavery in Egypt. For a long time, Joseph's life must not have appeared to him to have anything of goodness. But at the end of his life, he looks back and he tells his brothers that in retrospect, he can see the goodness of God. So we shouldn't trivialize this or make it into some kind of nice, childish, romantic matter. But I certainly think that absolutely in my own life, I have seen that same goodness of God working out.
Liam Priven, it's been great having you in to talk about these matters. Thanks so much for coming.
It's been a great pleasure. Thanks very much.